quiet for us.
Well, good evening, everyone, and welcome to the inaugural lecture of Professor Claudio Cibora, who is convener of the Department of Information Systems. Claudio also holds another chair at LSE, the PricewaterhouseCoopers Professor of Risk at the Center for Analysis of Risk and Regulation. Claudio started his academic career as an engineer, but he very soon saw the light and drifted into the area of socio-technical analysis of automated systems. Specifically, he was looking at robotics in a work environment. He concentrated on the impacts of information technology on human work and on organizational processes and structures. That having been said, Claudio is still in love with design, and this has directed the avant-garde remodeling of the Information Systems Department, as anyone who would visit the fifth floor of Tower 1 will recognize. Claudio first came to international prominence with his research linking the findings from new institutional economics to information systems. More recently, his work has focused on the phenomenological understanding of IT in organizations and the general messiness of everyday practice. He has published a number of books, probably the best known being From Control to Drift, The Dynamics of Information Infrastructures, published by the Oxford University Press in 2000. His latest book, The Labyrinths of Information, Challenging the Wisdom of Systems, also with the OUP, came out in the summer. Not being one to rest on his laurels, Claudio is now researching the application of information and communication technologies to e-government in developing countries. And this will be the topic of his talk this evening. And so it gives me great pleasure to introduce Professor Claudio Cibora. Thank you.
It's nice to be here and to see so many familiar faces, and also, of course, the students, master and doctor. Martin Heidegger, one of the continental philosophers who was most concerned about the role and essence of modern technology in our world, suggests that trying to figure out whether technology is a bad, good, or neutral means to an end is just a technical, instrumental discourse in itself. But if one wants to get to the essence of modern technology, he or she should avoid falling into the trap of a technical discourse. The essence of a tree is not something vegetable. Thus, the essence of modern technology is not something technical. We can retain from Heidegger's investigations two basic ideas on the essence of modern technology that will be useful to guide our social study of information technology today. The first is that technology is a way of revealing, a revealing that challenges nature, people, society, and the world. Second, that the challenge posed by modern technology has a very special and consistent form, captured by the German word Gestell. In a way, Gestell has the characteristics of what we would call today information systems and infrastructure of information systems, enabling and aligning all the processes in an organization. But the idea of infrastructure has a static connotation, the idea of structure, while the German word has the more dynamic component of the challenging. The word Gestell contains the root of the verb stellen, which means ordering and aligning. So the essence of modern technology is a way of revealing that challenges the world by ordering it, that is, by ordering resources, processes, people, and relationships. All are made present, available through order, calculus, and formalization, so that they can be recombined, aligned, aggregated, and made ready for further ordering. The danger represented by modern technology would lie precisely in this relentless process of ordering, by which reality, the world, people, first get represented in a calculable way, then they get shaped into available resources, ready to be deployed and to be ordered again. This is, in a nutshell, Heidegger's vision, a philosophical one. The social study of information and communication technology must be informed, I believe, by these and other philosophical reflections, both as an initial guide to frame the problems to be investigated empirically, and then as a reference point to keep the questioning alive during the appreciation and the evaluation of the results emerging out of the empirical research. We leave the two key ideas of technology as revealing and ordering for the moment. Today, they will inspire our discussion of the study of information and communication technology, and we will find their echo in the final consideration of this talk. But for now, let me host you for the next few minutes inside one of the research projects that are going on at our department, a research project carried out together with the Center of Analysis and Risk Regulations, always at LSE, and funded by PricewaterhouseCoopers. The project investigates the multiple risks of implementing complex information infrastructure in a variety of large organizations, both public and private. As a point of departure for this lecture, I will use a case study related to the implementation of e-government systems, services, and applications in the special context of a developing country, Jordan. Craig Barrett, Intel CEO, said just less than 1 month ago in Amman, Jordan, that Jordan has set a precedent for change in the Middle East region. It has demonstrated the achievements that can result from strong cooperation between the public and private sectors, particularly in the field of information and communication technology. Indeed, Jordan is a textbook case for its vision to become the Singapore or Bangalore of the Middle East in the field of adoption of new information and communication technologies. In its attempt to follow some of the best practice indicated by international agencies, from the World Bank to the UN, and the donors of various leading Western and Far Eastern countries, combined with the commitment expressed by the top of the state, the King himself and the Ministry of Information Technology, Jordan incarnates the new thinking and practice on how to introduce information technology to enable rapid social and economic progress. There is a variety of initiatives that attract the interest of the observer. They regard the creation of new jobs in the information technology sector and the launch of a software industry. Second, the diffusion of information technology in rural areas and the promotion of e-learning. Projects like connecting Jordanians or broadband to the schools. And last but not least, the establishment of a wide e-government program. I will focus my attention on the e-government initiative for a number of reasons. First, in Jordan, the public sector is still the largest employer, thus representing a very important economic organization. Second, because in this domain, one can find many of the actors also present in the other projects, donors, public and private partnerships, foreign governments wanting to provide help, and so on. Third, there is the possibility to study the deployment of a new infrastructure inside a large, complex administration in the context of improving its efficiency, but also to support the growth of the nation that is governed by it. This allows us to extend to the government organization in a developing country what we have learned in previous research projects focused on the corporate world about the deployment and management of information infrastructures. Jordan's e-government strategy is aimed at using new technologies to facilitate inter- and intra-agency communication and cooperation, as well as provide information and services to its citizens more efficiently. The program relies on four foundations: introduction of e-services, infrastructure development, education and training, and legal change. It focuses on the following broad objectives: increasing information accessibility, improving government performance and efficiency, reducing costs, ensuring transparency and visibility, promoting the ICT sector, e-skilling the public sector, boosting e-commerce activities. The e-government initiative is being implemented under the direction of a task force, an 8-member public-private committee headed by the newly formed Minister for Information Technology. The new ministry has been created through the privatization of the postal services and what was before the Ministry of Post and Telecommunications. It is responsible for setting the telecom policy and coordinating the e-government initiative, besides attracting investments in the information technology sectors and setting the ICT policies and strategy plans for the telecom and postal sector. In particular, the Ministry will set the technical standards and articulate the policy for the various government agencies to bring their data, services, and transactions online. A number of fast-track projects have been launched in year 2001. They include motoring services, taxation, and land registry. Next, there will be government-to-business and government-to-citizens portals and the government personal directory. A new network is envisaged to enable government to introduce knowledge management, empower and connect government staff. A program management office will establish standards and protocols for interconnecting government services together with the system integrators. Ditto for the development of a holistic view of a security strategy. The following government departments are involved in the main fast-track projects: Income Tax Department, Drivers and Vehicles Licensing Department, General Sales Tax Department, Department of Land Survey. Some of these departments are under the umbrella of the Ministry of Finance. Deloitte & Touche is the consulting firm awarded the contract for the analysis and design of the various processes and information requirements. And the principles that guide Deloitte & Touche in this particular contract are establishing proper governance structures for coordinating and promoting e-government initiatives in Jordan, identifying and implementing e-services, implementing a common e-government infrastructures, considering multiple channels beside the internet for providing services based on the level of their accessibility in Jordan, identifying and applying the changes necessary in Jordan's existing legislation systems for enabling e-service delivery, using a phased approach for implementation, monitoring citizen feedback and continuously evolving e-services based on user requirements, planning for management and change, and so on. In some cases, all the front office's activities were analyzed by Deloitte & Touche. In other two, only a selection of front office services were studied due to time constraints. Based on these project's recommendations, the Ministry of Information Technology will issue a request for a proposal to select partners for the purpose of creating the detailed, functional, and technical design. Since, in general, e-government is about the deployment of a complex information technology infrastructure, it faces an array of risks relative to the implementation, project management, and policy, all risks that have to be appropriately managed. It's still too soon to investigate into the actual risks of implementation because the projects are mostly still in the phase of analysis and design. Many fast-track projects are just completing these phases. But already at this early stage, a number of difficulties, some of them unexpected, have emerged. Whether they are going to be just momentary hurdles or severe obstacles is too early a call. Here I will give a flavor of the most important ones, those that in the private sector and corporate world have often proven to be cause of major disruption or at least significant drift in design and use. Then we narrow down onto a specific project, the one concerning the Department of Driving License and Motor Vehicles, in order to show how some of the hurdles in more detail can create some more general problems regarding the prevailing style of e-government, both in developed and advanced countries. The Jordan Public Administration is not a greenfield site, as far as IT is concerned. Rather, each ministry, department, and agency has been implementing over the years a number of applications. All these efforts come to represent the so-called installed base, or legacy systems of existing systems and applications, with which any new e-government initiative has to deal with somehow. There are ministries or areas more advanced than others, and a variety of infrastructures often incompatible or plainly not integrated or networked. Thus, when considering the fast-track projects, the one at the Department of Tax is relatively more advanced or ranks higher in the so-called technical readiness scale. In other services, like sales tax, new systems have been introduced just at the time of the analysis, but due to the lack of involvement and user participation, there is resistance in acceptance. The Department of Land Registry uses a database that does not support special techniques. Thus, an upgrade is in order. These and others are standalone systems. The analysts have found duplications, redundancy, and low quality of data. Note that these negative aspects have been observed not in relation to manual procedures and files, but in connection with already automated ones. In sum, the IT readiness is uneven. It is a matter of technology, the de facto independence and autonomy of the ministries, the different practices in systems implementation, sometime inappropriate involvement or training of users, the need for a deep cultural change towards the new ways of working, and so on. Now let me go to the specific case, of a very mundane case, of the drivers and vehicles licensing department. This is a very much heralded application in the consulting reports celebrating e-government in the US, web services in Nevada, Pennsylvania, and Alaska. It is a quintessential application where the idea of e-service comes to the fore. Better service to the citizens, decreased transaction costs, and opportunity for streamlining old-fashioned office operations, and the showcase application. Though the analysis was not yet finished at the time of our study, a number of unexpected potential risks have emerged, which seems to indicate that this application will be much more complex to implement. But not only that, the DFLD case is in itself a hologram, which includes in a nutshell many of the crucial problems of transferring e-government models and methodologies from advanced private and public organizations in developed countries to organizations operating in less developing countries. First, the existing platform and software will be hard to convert. We deal here with a non-centralized architecture, with non-systematic updating of the local and central databases, and mostly COBOL programs. The databases are not relational, hence it is cumbersome to run queries and give instructions. Overall, there is a low technical readiness. Also, employees are not very computer literate. If the technical backwardness was somehow expected, it came as a big surprise that the sheer number of dependencies and services surpassed the planning targets set by the analysis phase. So a straightforward application turns out to be decomposed into over 130 services that need to be documented. The list of dependencies is also impressive, about 35, and casts a shadow on the easiness of implementation. In other words, having a driving or other type of transport or vehicle licenses involves, in Jordan, internal transactions with the Prime Ministry, specifically the General Intelligence Department, the Public Security Department, the Chamber of Commerce, the Ministry of Exteriors, the Ministry of Industry and Trade, the Ministry of Health, the insurance companies, the local municipalities, and so on. Of course, dependencies vary according to the product or service, depending whether public vehicle or truck or whatever. But all this is making the analysis job very complex. Add the fact that the analysts need many statistics on the actual state of things, and these are unavailable, unreliable, and late. Some processes still now have an uncertain description because their unfolding is hard to identify in a reliable manner. Compound on that the angry orphans phenomenon. The IT people threatened by the new application, which will entail dropping COBOL, the old software language standard, create obstacles that again can make the analysis work extraordinarily difficult and incomplete. Also, the new system must decrease the duration of the transaction between the service and the other various dependencies. If this is not achieved, the mere speeding up of the procedures inside the department will not have a significant impact on the overall service delivery time, made of the service time combined with the dependencies time. Finally, a basic requirement is the possibility of shuffling documents between departments electronically. This is difficult until the service adopts the electronic transaction law and its recommendations. Once this problem is solved, then one has to tackle the electronic integration through 35 different organizations, with many of those dependencies not being computerized at all or having different computing systems. On top of it, integration will entail interlinked accounting practices, since citizens have to pay for some of the dependencies involved. Now they pay each ministry or agency separately, while an integrated procedure would require redistributing separate payments for a global price for the service. In such a maze, the way out chosen by the analyst might make the problem worse in the future. For example, they get the information and sanction authority they need to carry out the analysis, bypassing the department altogether. Typically, they would turn to the another department, the Public Security Department, which is more cooperative, but this might create further animosity in the future when the implementation phase arrives. Then, in lack of a reliable standard documentation, the raw processes are hard to access, Ministry of Technology design standards and global best practices imported by the consultants internationally are made to replace the missing or lacking identification of the activities. These moves are solving the problem for the analysts today in meeting their deadline, but will make implementation more risky in the sense that the new processes may be grafted upon unclear, poorly understood activities. In this respect, the final concerns are about change management. It is to be expected the need for huge efforts of change management and training to overcome resistance, to educate the computer illiterate, to change the management model. The latter, by the way, will imply a radical cultural change, moving from a rigid, control-oriented management style to a process organization servicing the customer. Note that the transition is not from a public bureaucracy to a market organization, what all the new public management talks about, but it's about from a military culture to a business market culture. The high risks and complexities of such a transition point to what may be the dangers hidden in this apparently banal application. Put in a nutshell, successful implementation and delivery of e-services demands the transformation of some parts of the Jordan state structure from a security apparatus into a transparent, maybe even democratic, service agency, where a driving license is not a public security or general intelligence document, but just a quasi-commercial product. In sum, a mundane application chosen because of its low risk and high yield in terms of buying citizens into the idea and experience of e-government turns out to be already in the analysis phase a hologram in the small of the difficulties of e-government in a developing country. Extremely complex, high risk, and calling into question the role of the state in relation to its citizens, a service provider or a public security. From this perspective, the electronic transaction law requires, among other things, that its provision be interpreted according to the International Trade Conventions, Article 6. This may be easily adopted by a department providing certificates to citizens, and thus transform its administrative acts into market services. But it may be much more difficult to implement by security or intelligence arm of the state. So far, the case study. Now, this case study is also an occasion, in the first analysis, to look at technology ordering effects, that is, transforming the relationship, the transaction between the citizen and the state into another type of transactions, a transaction between a customer and a service that sells services. So the technology now tries to order these transactions, but also reveals its ramifications. And let's look at what are these ramifications of transforming and ordering transactions between citizens and the state into customers with the state as a service provider. The epochal transformation of a government department from a public security military culture into a market-like service is just one extreme instance of the changes implied by most e-government applications. This is part of a wider shift whereby citizens become customers, as recommended by the new public management movement, very much alive in this country. Jane Fountain, professor at the Kennedy School, has carried out a useful survey of the wide-ranging implications of such a move. Her contribution helps us understanding the difficulties that today's prevailing style of e-government applications will encounter. First, the notion of a customer service by competing private firms entails a number of mechanisms typical of a market economy, which cannot be completely transferred to a public administration possessing a monopoly of the service. On a competitive market, the customer has choice. It's not always the case for citizens' customers. Who else provides driving licenses? On the other hand, the citizens have no exit options and there are no real prices. At a closer look of how a firm functions versus a public service, another difference stands out, and a big scam on new public management is revealed. Firms try primarily to satisfy shareholders and not customers. Customer relationship management does not have a value per se, but only as an instrument to increase shareholder value. And in order to do so, firms proceed to segment the market to implement various forms of price discrimination, all tactics that increase the inequality among customers. But equality of service is, in principle, the goal of an administration providing a universal service. Furthermore, any attempt to govern transactions through market-like mechanisms implies a certain degree of standardization in the service provided. The less the service can be actually standardized, the more the bureaucracy, especially the one facing directly the customer or citizen and subject to internal performance monitoring standards, this bureaucracy will be involved in what? Stereotyping, simplifying, and basically serving those clients who are easier to serve, creating thus a sort of discrimination not based on price but on access and ease of interaction. Service quality and customer services correlate in the private sector with socioeconomic status. The more rich, the richer you are, the better you're off. The same applies for the way businesses respond to voicing customers. In the public sector, the more customer complaint handling is market-like, the more it will end reflecting citizens' status inequalities. Also, the equivalence between citizens and customers place them in a very specific role, the one of rational choice theory consumers. Whether this fiction works in actual markets or not is of a secondary importance, given the fact that the variety of roles played by citizens cannot be reduced to the one of a consumer with clear preferences pulled by the prices and quality of goods or services. The public administration operates often in an area where goals and preferences are ambiguous and hard to be identified and expressed, especially for those vulnerable citizens lacking scope for choice. Customers on markets are involved ideally in spot transactions. The market is a wonderful means to aggregate such spot demands and supply matching offers. But the more a transaction is specific, sticky, and long-term, the more markets tend to fail and must be governed by long-term integrative arrangements. The citizen, as a member of a democracy or a community rather than a police state, is in for a long-term relationship which cannot be fully split down into transaction bits to be aggregated. The expression of political, long-term obligation and the development of a polity are hard to obtain in purely aggregative relationships. It becomes possible only in the context of a participatory democracy where popular sovereignty matters more than consumer sovereignty. State governing bodies and administrative apparatus are all part of the effort to govern the population. They are the arm of politics, seen as the art of conflict resolution. But the latter is at odds with market segmentation and demand aggregation. It is then not so obvious that by introducing more efficient electronic transactions, a bureaucratic military administration will become more transparent, efficient, and market-like. First, it will maintain its monopoly. Second, it will be compelled to standardize services so to be able to offer them electronically. But such standardization will entail stereotyping, segmenting, privileging those sectors of the population that can access the services more easily. Democracy will not be increased, nor competition, and favoritism and bribery might simply move to new intermediaries. It is all about agencies as efficient e-service providers or political institutions as instrument of democracy. As shown in the driving license case, the irony is that the two cannot be disentangled, and the provision of efficient e-service may require dramatic transformation in the governance of the population, an issue of governmentality, as Foucault would point out. So, first we have seen how technology orders this, but also this ordering reveals a lot of problems. And this ordering of transforming the relationship between citizens and administration in relationship between a service provider and customers is part of a larger maneuver, a larger move, where technology is actually applied to enforce the marketization of the state, that is a global reordering of transactions and government. But also this ordering reveals new incongruences. Let's examine these broader implications. The road to good governance through e-government applications based on the transformation of the transaction with customers and not citizens involves risks and side effects for democracy, participation, and civic engagement. Professor Fountain concludes her analysis by suggesting that the growing incursion of market metaphors into political life may further the already disturbing erosion of civic responsibility and civic engagement. Could then we be weakening the chances of democracy and development by pursuing e-government projects? More in general, does the model of state enabled by e-government really support development and democracy? In fact, e-government is supposed to be conducive to development by sustaining so-called good governance. And in the strategies of the international organizations like the World Bank and the IMF gathered around the so-called Washington and Monterey consensus, good governance is delivered by a specific model of minimal state, or the service delivery model, for which we have seen a specific instance in the driving license case. This model is supposed to address state failures due to governance failure, corruption, rent-seeking, distortion in markets, and absence of democracy. The service delivery state can provide law and order, enforce property rights, deliver public goods and services to the customer citizens. It is minimal, transparent, and accountable. The model comes with the idea that development is enabled by a well-working market economy, where contracts can be enforced, property rights are clear and stable, and there is low corruption. There are few restrictions on competition. Markets tend to be rent-free, few monopolies, no subsidies, ubiquitous access to information. And investors are confident because property rights are stable. To be sure, such model of service delivery, minimal state, embeds the style of governance present in advanced Western economies. E-government, together with other institutional reforms, is aimed at helping nations to leapfrog underdevelopment and attain a final governance configuration which is similar to the one of developed Western countries. So what is wrong with this approach that provides a meaningful context to e-government initiative? Are we against stable property rights? Are we in favor of corruption? Are we against efficient service delivery to the citizens through information technology? Of course not. However, as the previous analysis regarding the transformation of citizens into customers has highlighted, we should not neglect some evidence and further facets of the problem of governance and development, especially in their dynamic interaction. Namely, first, the few states which actually have experienced a high-growth economy are not ranking high on the various dimensions of good governance, corruption, democracy, transparency. The institutional reforms needed to transform the developing country into an advanced one portray only the end state, but do not tell us anything on how to actually undergo the transition from the initial to the end state. In particular, a few development economies point out that it is hard to establish a clear correlation between the service delivery state and development. Second, the few high-growth economies in Asia showed that their earlier decades were characterized by a much more interventionist role of the state, as my colleague Robert Wade says. For example, with states actively manipulating property rights through land reform, or allocating rents to growth-enhancing activities and groups, such as training entrepreneurs in specific sectors of the economy. Also, they had only slightly better governance quality than many poorly performing countries. The same applies for corruption levels, not significantly different and in some cases even worse than average. Then we can apply to the service delivery minimal state idea the same critique that can be applied to much of the new institutional economics views of institutions. According to the letter, only efficient organizations and institutions survive, those which deliver low transaction costs. Thus, institutions and organizations to compete and survive need to lower transaction costs. Unfortunately, this recommendation is not enough to explain why certain organizations are able to make such moves while others are unable to implement them. And the approach says nothing about the transition, how to manage it and how to lower its costs. Embedded in the new institutional economics, there are very naive ideas about change, political transition costs, and learning, since they are assumed to be frictionless processes. In the small of the driving license case, I have shown how having in mind an official model of delivering driving licenses through the internet may clash with the entrenched ways of working of the administration, and in general with the model of state and the nature of the relationship between the state and the citizen. In other words, the consensus policies, while focusing more on good governance, minimal state, and e-government, tend to underestimate what it takes to imitate change and learn new conducts, procedures, and practices. Looked at in this perspective, the role of information technology is less clear-cut, less significant, and most probably irrelevant. First, what matters here are the transformation and learning capabilities that are not necessarily supported by efficiency-enhancing IT applications. The distinction is subtle but of great importance. E-government for good governance is simply a description of the applications one could get in order for an efficient government to serve its customers or citizens. The flaw is that this strategy may work where the state has already a typical advanced country configuration. It does not help the transition, or probably might even hinder it. Indeed, a few economists point out that there is no historical example of a country that first improved governance and then attained advanced country levels of per capita income. Second, rises in per capita income seems to precede the emergence of democracy, and not the other way around. We can conclude that the present range of applications and systems that usually are labeled e-government is attached to a model of state, the service delivery one, which resembles closely the state form in advanced Western economies. However, there is the suspicion that such a model may be irrelevant to actually trigger development. At the limit, the reverse can be true. Once an economy is fully developed, then the service delivery model makes sense and the government can function, as some, but not all, applications in the service delivery in the UK, US, and other advanced countries show. As the Jordan case points out, though in a very embryonic form, seeking the implementation of efficient service delivery will lead at best to the point where a radical transformation is required to make the applications function. But ICT do not enable such changes per se. In a way, they presuppose them. What are then the risks of developing countries getting trapped in spending resources to push major reforms like e-government on the basis of models which may not work in contexts that are significantly different from the one of the advanced countries? The risk could be of more cynicism, disillusion, and investments in IT could turn into some form of growth-reducing rents. The final question is then, why countries like Jordan get trapped in facing high enforcement costs of policies to renew the state through e-government and other new public management reforms or illusions? And why donors and international agencies seem to be driven into the same tunnel vision of promoting and supporting designs that are unrealistic, since they tend to ignore the complex problems of transformation, transition, and they are linked to an idea of state, the e-service delivery one, that actually may not be conducive to development? Here, in trying to answer to these questions, we touch the limits of the e-government, good governance, and service delivery state consensus. We need to get into another perspective. A clue for a new interpretation of the dilemmas emerging above can be found in the recent document of the U.S. government titled The National Security Strategy of the USA, September 2002. You can read a passage that says, "Finally, the United States will use this moment of opportunity to extend the benefits of freedom across the globe. We will actively work to bring the hope of democracy, development, free markets, and free trade to every corner of the world. The events of September 11, 2001 taught us that weak states, like Afghanistan, can pose as great a danger to our national interests as strong states. Poverty does not make poor people into terrorists and murderers. Yet poverty, weak institutions, and corruption can make weak states vulnerable to terrorist networks and drug cartels within their border." In this strategy document of the White House, the link is established between the danger posed by weak states and what can happen within their borders, and the need for a countering influence based on the ideas of free markets, trade, democracy, and development to be pushed across the globe in every corner of the world. Throughout this document, aid, reform of the state, free markets are intimately connected with the issue of security. What I suggest here is to take the issue of security seriously, as the source of the relevance of this White House document warrant, and look at the current efforts of e-government initiatives in developing countries in a different, more global perspective. For example, the social study of information technology is usually interested in how systems get developed, through which constellation and alignment of actors. In this respect, what is striking for the Jordan case, as well as other cases in e-government in developing countries, is that the implementation of the project takes place through the multiple interventions of a variety of actors: ministries and departments, aid agencies, consulting firms, the UN, NGOs, multinational companies, multilateral financial bodies, foreign states, regional entrepreneurial association, and a variety of alliances between these actors. Many of these actors are private organizations, and the impression could be that the new way to provide e-government and better a good governance happens through complex and articulated forms of private-public partnerships, where the presence of powerful intermediaries like the IT multinationals or the global consulting firms somehow indicates that aid is more and more delivered by non-state entities. This would be yet another sign of globalization, the weakening of the traditional influence of the national states in favor of a more fragmented, overlapping set of private and public intermediaries. One could conclude that states are delegating, if not right out, subcontracting or outsourcing their tasks and resources dealing with aid to the more specialized and professional agencies. This would be part of the increasing externalization of activities traditionally performed by states, now delegated more and more to multinationals and NGOs. The US security strategy document suggests a different interpretation. The public-private network and contractual regimes of aid practice are the new means by which metropolitan states want to achieve security on a global scale. Underdevelopment is now dangerous, not only for the people directly immersed into it, but for us as well. Under the rubric of human security, the concerns for stability of the metropolitan state have been made to merge with the social agenda of the aid agencies. If poverty and underdevelopment encourage conflict and instability, then sustainable development can also play a security role. The networks of aid practice become the ways for the metropolitan states to cross the borders of the marginal weak states and implement flexibly new forms of governance, both of the economy and the state. Typically, the self-regulating market is one technology of choice for controlling, able to shape the networks and systems of opportunity between which less developing countries operate. In this way, as my colleague Nicholas Rose suggests, control by metropolitan states is not direct or centralized, but flows through a network of open circuits that are non-hierarchical but rhizomatic. Note also that behind the notion of good governance, as supported by e-government, a subtle shift has taken place. Underdeveloped, potentially dangerous states are now monitored and regulated as a social body. Through free market, accountability, transparency, and corruption-curbing policies, it is the very culture and conduct of people that needs to be impacted. Through information technology and new public management ideas, what one wants to affect is the governmentality of the weak states, that is, the way they think about their own functioning and reform, by providing a very specific way to regulate the conduct of citizens, for example, by transforming them in rational choice consumers. Modern regulatory techniques create the possibility of modulating the behavior of populations through controlling processes and networks, rather than disciplining individuals like in the old colonialism. And this takes place at a distance, or with very little territorial presence of experts and functionaries, rather than through territorial occupation as in old colonialism. Like the computer and network-based systems they end up in implementing, such techniques involve continuous measurement of conduct, risk and readiness. You invest aid where you get the fastest and more reliable return, so you need to measure throughout. The same applies to the management of the projects and the comportment of the experts. Information technology can be a driving force in allowing the new way of accounting and risk analysis to take place. The new flexibility and accountability of development aid practice are valued because of the changing geopolitical situations. From a political landscape made of strong states facing each other, competing through political alliances, nuclear deterrence, and armed superiority, and where aid was a means for strong states to seek alliances with weak but strategically positioned states in the less developed parts of the world, we move to a landscape characterized by low-intensity regional conflicts, global terrorism, where the old forms of alliance and deterrence are not effective any longer. The present situation has been described as one of durable endemic disorder, a situation where constant crisis management is needed to avoid total systemic collapse, but root problems get seldom effectively addressed. We would argue with Professor Duffield that a new possibility of achieving security has emerged in which non-state organizations now provide innovative forms of mobilization, means of intervention in the interest of global liberal governance. But far from solving in this way durable disorder, the latter continues to subsist as a side effect of the very way metropolitan states try to address the new security dilemmas and develop the new public-private systems of influence. A number of elements lead us to support this interpretation. First, the changing nature of war and security in the last few years and the events that we all know happening in various parts of the globe. In the borderlands nations, conflict destroys the social fabric. Widespread human rights abuse and the fact that civilians are deliberate targets become the organic components of the new style of war. Ethnic cleansing providing a strong justification for the metropolitan state for intervention, and a stronger than before will to govern. Except in the extreme cases like Afghanistan in the most recent past, this will to govern through reform cannot find an expression in a direct intervention. Rather, it becomes the engine animating the new style of governing at a distance through the public, private networks of aid and the reforms programs such as e-government. Development has always involved some form of mobilization for order and security from the very beginning. Today, order is achieved by allowing the archetypal self-regulating process, the market, to install itself and expand by creating and enacting those institutions that allow the free market to emerge. The minimal state, accompanied by the new public management and e-government, is the typical reform for the public-private network of aid practice will deliver in order to have markets. Such networks, set up originally as short-term remedial interventions, tend to become a permanent framework giving coherence and linking aid and political actors. In Jordan, for example, the public-private network includes actors such as UNDP, USAID, but also Cisco, Siemens, Intel, Microsoft, EDS, beside the key ministries. While on the surface, the issue raised by the G8 Digital Opportunity Task Force covered the relative e-readiness of a developing country, the digital divide, higher levels of efficiency through marketization, and more transparency, the present social study of e-government applications shows that the G8 agenda is a facade of what the phenomenon of e-government policies for developing countries is probably not. Below the surface, the driving forces are order and security in a new war context. The market is achieving self-regulating order without direct intervention. Aid is a technology of control, and ICT is a technology enabling all the such strategies. However, as shown for the case of large information infrastructures in large multinationals, the deployment of information technologies, a technology for control, is never fully effective and tends to generate a variety of side effects and out-of-control dynamics that threaten the very management control strategy. The same may apply at the global level. The metropolitan states wanting to control at a distance the borderland states through reforms and new infrastructure implemented through new flexible networks of private public aid agencies may fail, and their attempts backfire, leading to more systems, knowledge spread unevenly in the population, more autonomy, scattered resistance, and possibly more, not less durable disorder. At this point, a whole range of promising research topics emerge from this comprehensive perspective. Let me mention three of them. First of all, information technology in actual, not dream development. First, a new study of the role of information technology, the role that information technology can play in developing countries, the one linked to the so-called actual existing development. Think about the new scattered wars that generate a variety of businesses, trans-regional supply and service chains, transporting arms, people, documents. All these activities generate a shadow economy, opaque and non-territorial, of impressive proportions according to some observers. Organized scattered violence generate an informal economy, labeled of the actually existing development. This has emerged not because of official development, it has arisen despite of it. There are no statistics about the extent and quality of the use of information technology in this shadow sector of the economy. But whatever is being deployed, that would be an important evidence to illustrate the multiple roles played by information technology in actual versus dream development. Second research topic, risk analysis and other technologies of ordering. The vast deployment of new technologies of control and governance at a distance is supported by the systematic adoption of new public management models, whereby professional experts are substituted by managers and administrators, and new extensive accounting systems and performance monitoring techniques are applied. In particular, the logic of risk analysis, through which every aspect of a complex reality is ordered and made calculable so as to be amenable to control and governance, from the degree of danger of a war zone, the hazard posed by a rogue state, up to the e-readiness of a nation, the chances of success of an aid intervention, the risks of a system development project, all these things can be ordered and driven to be made calculable. Risk analysis in itself is a technology aimed at ordering reality to set it up for calculation, reduce uncertainty, and colonize the future. But this way of proceeding creates new dangers, new ignorance, new uncertainties, and new risks. Third project, the new knowledge frontier. The increased ordering of resources and relationships made possible by the techniques of new public management, project management, quality control, may clash with the local idiosyncratic knowledge which characterized the scattered territories and communities in the new war. Frequent knowledge gaps are bound to appear whenever the two logic meet or most probably clash. These are the new zones of uncertainty and hence risk. These are the pockets that keep disorder alive and thriving, where new knowledge is created and flows outside the circuits of securitized development aid and e-states. If my analysis so far captures at least in part what is going on in these fields, it's highly likely that in the world of durable disorder, institutions and organizations, both state and private, despite or rather because of the relentless action of ordering, calculation, planning and control, end up operating more and more as spaced up assemblages. They do deliver governance and knowledge, and they plan and influence the allocation of resources and the conduct of people, but with much less coherence and consistency. They resemble, as Foucault and lately Nicholas Rose reminded us, a tingly sculpture machine, you can observe in Basel or in Paris, full of parts that come from elsewhere, strange couplings, change relations, cogs and levers that do not work as expected, but that do produce, nevertheless, policies, actions, and social dynamics. Their precise mechanical components and their disordered assembly create multiple zones of uncertainty, platforms also for imagining new combinations and enacting local improvisations. It is towards these interstices that the social study of information technology should point its attention, to identify those natural experiments, transgressive initiatives, and alternative practices in technology design and use. This could represent the seeds of models alternative to those based on the pursuit of order and control, being today deployed uniformly across the globe in private as well as public organizations, in developed as well developing countries, and which I think contribute to the regimen of durable disorder. The aim of the social study of information technology is not only to understand how many of the present models, methods, and solutions contribute to durable disorder in corporations, in states, and in states, but also to find out and actively cultivate all those instances of alternative design approaches present in the knowledge-intensive business within the metropolitan states and in the communities of the borderland states, where new practices and models also there emerge daily. Again, it was Martin Heidegger to suggest, in discussing the danger represented by modern technology, that where the greatest danger lies, and this is the all-encompassing ordering effect of Gestell, well, there also the same essence of technology must harbor a saving power. Along the fragmented knowledge frontier, traced by the advancing technologies of ordering and the resisting idiosyncratic practices, a frontier that cuts across organizations, states, and communities in advance as well as in less developing countries, lies today a new laboratory for critical research, for the information systems and the other allied disciplines. A laboratory to which LSE and my department in particular will dedicate renewed effort and passionate work. Thank you.
We have 5 minutes, so we do have time for a couple of questions.
Much better to obviously in Jordan it would have been much better to have designed a sensible system as in the West or not done or done nothing. And the other thing is, what effect in undeveloped countries is that effect that we seem to have in the West, where if you put it on computer the problem solved, you know, and where in fact the crises such as in Asia, economic crisis or the security problems seem to have got even more inefficient despite the billions of screens. So would that happen to a greater degree in some undeveloped countries?
Well, my effort was to try to show how problems in so-called remote areas in this regime of globalization are more and more interlinked with problems you can find maybe within the borders of a multinational company having plenty of expertise and resources in information technology. First of all, because the models applied are being uniformly the same all across the boards with very little adaptation to local context. Second, because in all these instances they tend to generate the clash between the advancing information technology and its logic and the resisting cultures in an office, on the shop floor, in the journal clans, whatever. There is this continuous, knowledge, what I call the new knowledge frontier, where disorder emerges at micro, macro level. Now, it would be interesting to follow the path of these sources of disorder.
Professor Cibora, I don't think this mic is on.
I cannot help you.
Okay. Yeah. I had not realized the ambitious degree of the Jordanian strategic initiative in LCT to become the new Bangalore of the Middle East. Depending upon the success they have in achieving this objective, I wonder whether there might not be rather welcome political implications on the regional level of the Middle East.
Well, again, you can interpret this thing in two ways. One is the effort of a fairly advanced developing country having identified a possible niche, saying, okay, we can play the role in the Middle East, in the Arab world, since the Jordanian population has high literacy levels, convert these high literacy levels in a new industry for the new economy, the software industry, for example. On the other hand, and you see, all this complex network of international agencies providing and multinationals providing plenty of resources. But on the other hand, one should not forget the strategic role of Jordan, which is, buffering between Israel and Iraq. So what is going on there? Probably both of these things are working at the same time. Now, I'm not at all criticizing or evaluating the program, the industrial policy program. I just analyzed and somewhat criticized the e-government effort, which is only a part of the global ICT or information or Jordan Information Society initiative.
Reception upstairs in the City Common?
Yes, at the fifth floor.
So everyone is welcome. I'd like to finish by saying I have a much better title for the talk because Claudio's given the impression that e-government is just the latest of this e-mania. So I think he should call it to e or not to e. That is the question. Thank you.